Clinton's presidency was over, that Adams, in a letter to a friend, took up the subject of Callender, Jefferson, and Sally Hemings, privately offering several opinions and suggesting at the close of the letter, "You may burn it if you please." For Callender, Adams had no use whatever. "I believe nothing that Callender said any more than if it had been said by an infernal spirit. I would not convict a dog of killing a sheep upon the testimony of two such witnesses," Adams wrote with characteristic verve, indicating that he did not believe Callender's accusations about Jefferson. Jefferson's charities to Callender, however, were a disgrace. "I give him up to censure for this, and I have a better right to do so because my conscience bears me witness that I never wrote a line against my enemies nor contributed one farthing to any writer for vindicating me or accusing my enemies." But continuing on, Adams clearly implied that in fact he did believe Callender. An unnamed great lady who knew the South, he wrote, had said she did not believe there was a planter in Virginia who could not reckon among his slaves a number of children. Then Adams put the issue squarely where it belonged, saying in essence that all such stories of slave masters and their slave women were metaphors for the overriding sin of slavery itself. "Callender and Sally will be remembered as long as Jefferson as blots on his character. The story of the latter is a natural and almost unavoidable consequence of that foul contagion in the human character, Negro slavery." Abigail, to judge by her correspondence, had no wish to say anything on the subject, or to have any contact with Jefferson. She did not consider him a great man, she had told Thomas earlier. She pitied his weakness and took much that he professed to be hollow. "Still," she wrote, "there was a little corner of my heart where once he sat, and from whence I find it hard wholly to discard him." But in the spring of 1804, nearly 2 years after the Callender accusations, Abigail learned of the death of Jefferson's daughter, Mary Jefferson Epps, the Polly for whom she had felt such affection during the child's stay with her in London. Deeply touched, Abigail wrote Jefferson to express her heartache and sympathy. Until then, she had not written a word to him in 17 years, not since London. Reasons of various kinds had withheld her pen, she explained, until the powerful feelings of my heart have burst through the restraint. The attachment which I formed for her when you committed her to my care has remained with me to this hour. Yet she signed herself not in friendship or as his friend, but as one who once took pleasure in subscribing herself your friend. Her letter profoundly moved him, Jefferson wrote from the president's house. He would ever remember her kindness to Polly, he said, at the same time expressing regret that circumstances should have arisen which seemed to draw a line between us. He wished to be friends still. "The friendship with which you honored me has ever been valued and fully reciprocated, and although events have been passing which might be trying to some minds, I never believed yours to be of that kind, nor felt that my own was. Neither my estimate of your character nor the esteem founded in that have ever been lessened for a single moment." Reflecting on his friendship with Adams, he recalled how it had accompanied them through long and important scenes, and that while their differences of opinion, resulting from honest conviction, might make them seem rivals in the minds of their fellow citizens, they were not in their own minds. "We never stood in one another's way." There Jefferson might well have ended the letter, and the extraordinary exchange that followed with Abigail would never have happened. But he had a wound to air. "I can say with truth that one act of Mr. Adams's life, and only one, ever gave me a moment's personal displeasure. I did consider his last appointments to office as personally unkind. It seemed but common justice to leave a successor free to act by instruments of his own choice. Affirming his high respect for her husband, he closed, saying, "I have thus, my dear madam, opened myself to you without reserve, which I have long wished an opportunity of doing, and without knowing how it will be received, I feel relief from being unbosomed." Abigail left little doubt of her anger in what she wrote in reply. "He had no right to complain of his predecessor's appointment," she lectured Jefferson. "The Constitution empowered the President to fill offices when they were vacant, and Mr. Adams had chosen well. Besides," she argued inaccurately, "he made his choices before it was known whether he, Jefferson, or Burr would be president. And so Jefferson had no cause to take personal offense." Then, mincing no words, she got to what for her was the heart of the matter. However smoothly he wrote of past differences being only those resulting from honest conviction, she refused to let him slide by. "And now, sir, I will freely disclose to you what has severed the bonds of former friendship and placed you in a light very different from what I once viewed you in." She was outraged by his dealings with Callender, and particularly as revealed in the letters Callender had published. Of the accusations concerning Sally Hemings, she said nothing. The issue to her was Callender, who by then was dead. He had been found on a Sunday in June 1803 in Richmond, floating by the shore of the James River in 3 feet of water. He had been seen earlier wandering the town in a drunken state, but the circumstances of his death were unknown. Abigail mistakenly understood that Jefferson had liberated the wretch Callender from jail, and this, to her, was totally unacceptable, after the attacks Callender had made on Adams, a man, she reminded Jefferson, for whom you profess the highest esteem and friendship. Was he not, as president, she asked, answerable for the influence of his example upon the manners and morals of the nation? She had tried, she said, to believe him innocent of any part in Callender's slanderous attacks. "Until I read Callender's 7th letter, containing your compliment to him as a writer, and your reward of $50, I could not be made to believe that such measures could have been resorted to. To stab the fair fame and upright intentions of one who, to use your language, was acting from an honest conviction in his own mind that he was right. This, sir, I considered as a personal injury. This was the sword that cut asunder the Gordian knot which could not be untied by all the efforts of party spirit, by rivalship, by jealousy, or any other malignant fiend. The serpent you cherished and warmed bit the hand that nourished him, and gave you sufficient specimens of his talents, his gratitude, his justice, and his truth. When such vipers are let loose upon society, all distinction between virtue and vice are leveled. All respect for character is lost." Her letter, she assured him, was written in confidence. She had shown it to no one. "Faithful are the wounds of a friend," she concluded, quoting Proverbs. "I bear no malice, I cherish no enmity. I would not retaliate if I could. Nay, more in the true spirit of Christian charity, I would forgive, as I hope to be forgiven." Jefferson protested. He was being falsely accused. "My charities to him, Callender, were no more meant as encouragements to his scurrilities than those I give to the beggar at my door are meant as rewards for the vices of his life, and to make them chargeable to myself." He had never suspected Adams of being party to the atrocities committed against him by Fenno and Porcupine, so why should he be suspected? He himself had ever borne testimony to Mr. Adams's personal wrath, he assured her. It was all quite disingenuous, as doubtless Abigail knew. Jefferson had, indeed, encouraged and paid Callender for his efforts, and he had spoken of Adams in quite unflattering terms on a number of occasions. Altogether, 7 letters passed between Abigail and the president, in the course of which she brought up one further matter that, to her mind, had put great strain on the past friendship. A district judge had earlier appointed John Quincy a commissioner of bankruptcy in Boston, a petty federal office involving petty fees, but that had made a difference to him in his first lean year in Boston. When, under Jefferson, John Quincy was suddenly replaced, Abigail had taken it as an act of personal reprisal by Jefferson himself, which it was not, as he managed now to convince her. I conclude with sincere prayers for your health and happiness, that yourself and Mr. Adams may long enjoy the tranquility you desire and merit, Jefferson wrote, bringing to a conclusion his part in the exchange. Abigail wished him well in his responsibilities and promised to intrude on his time no more. But his part as a rewarder and encourager of Callender, a libeler whom you could not but detest and despise, she could not and would not forget. Once she had felt both affection and esteem for him, she wrote. Affection still lingers in the bosom, even after esteem has taken flight. This, her last letter, was written on October 25, 1804. On November 19th, Adams wrote the following at the bottom of her letter book copy. The whole of this correspondence was begun and conducted without my knowledge or suspicion. Last evening and this morning, at the desire of Mrs. Adams, I read them whole. I have no remarks to make upon it at this time and in this place. Section 3. The prospect of writing an autobiography had never really appealed to Adams. Writing history was difficult at best, he knew, and if personal history, it could be most discomforting. It is a delicate thing to write from memory, he told John Quincy. To me, the undertaking would be too painful. I cannot but reflect upon scenes I have beheld. So having barely begun his projected memoir in the fall of 1802, he let it drop. For more than a year, he wrote little at all, devoting the greater part of his time to the farm. As always, he read much of every day, old favorites in Latin, Greek, and French, English poetry and history, journals such as the Edinburgh Review, and newspapers to the point he feared he might become a newspaper, as button maker becomes button at last. He saw a few old friends, went on long walks with Richard Cranch, attended church, and hugely enjoyed the company of his grandchildren. But his days on the move, on the road, were truly over. Only on rare occasions did he go even to Boston or Cambridge, to attend a Harvard commencement or a dinner of the American Academy of Sciences. At 4th of July celebrations in Boston, he would join Robert Treat Paine and Elbridge Gerry in the place of honor as surviving signers of the Declaration of Independence. But at the most now, the radius of his world was about 15 miles. Like Abigail, he worried about Thomas, who seemed incapable of taking hold in Philadelphia and suffered spells of gloom and loneliness, his blue devils. And with Abigail, he rejoiced when Thomas quit Philadelphia and moved back to Quincy to try a fresh start. Thomas's presence, the pleasure of his company in the evenings, helped compensate for the large vacant place in the Adams's life since the departure of John Quincy for Washington. For her part, Abigail told John Quincy to eat well, not work too hard, and mind his appearance. I do not wish a senator to dress like a beau, but I want him to conform so far as to the fashion as not to incur the character of singularity, nor give occasion to the world to ask what kind of mother he had, or to charge upon a wife negligence and inattention when she is guiltless. The neatest man, observed a lady the other day, wants his wife to pull up his collar and mind that his coat is brushed. John Quincy took his seat in the Senate in time to give Jefferson support in the biggest accomplishment of his presidency, the purchase of the Louisiana Territory. With the acquisition of Louisiana from Spain, Napoleon Bonaparte had begun planning a French empire in North America. But when the army he sent to crush the slave revolt in San Domingo was wiped out by war and yellow fever, Bonaparte abandoned his plans, and suddenly in 1803 offered to sell the United States all of the vast, unexplored territory of Louisiana. It was an astounding turn of events, and one that probably would not have come to pass had the quasi-war burst into something larger. Were it not for John Adams making peace with France, there might never have been a Louisiana Purchase. Federalists in Congress argued that under the Constitution, the powers of the president did not include buying foreign territory. Jefferson, who had for so long advocated less, not more, power in the executive, chose to take a larger view now, given the opportunity he had to double the size of the nation at a stroke. John Quincy crossed party lines to support the purchase, which his father, too, strongly favored. "Curse the stripling, how he apes his sire," declared one irate Massachusetts Federalist. When John Quincy joined in an unsuccessful attempt to stop the spread of slavery into Louisiana, he found it harder than pulling a jaw tooth, he told his father. "This is now, in general, the great art of legislation at this place," he continued, venting his frustration. "To do a thing by assuming the appearance of preventing it. To prevent a thing by assuming that of doing it." In the summer of 1804, on the banks of the Hudson River at Weehawken, New Jersey, Alexander Hamilton was fatally wounded in a duel with Vice President Aaron Burr. Carried back across the river to New York, Hamilton died the next day, July 12th. When the Vice President returned to Washington to preside over the Senate, he was looked upon by many, including young Senator Adams, as no better than a murderer. John Adams would write that though he had forgiven his arch-enemy Hamilton, Hamilton's villainy was not forgotten. "Nor did he feel obliged to suffer my character to lie under infamous calumnies because the author of them, with a pistol bullet in his spinal marrow, died a penitent." In the election of 1804, Jefferson and George Clinton of New York, the vice presidential candidate for the Republicans, won by an overwhelming margin. Even Massachusetts went for Jefferson. Much that John Quincy wrote to his parents from the Capitol had a familiar ring. "Hitherto, my conduct has given satisfaction to neither side," he observed, "and both are offended at what they consider a vain and foolish presumption of singularity, or an ambition of taking a lead different from the views of either. All this I cannot help." John Quincy and Louisa Catherine had dined at the president's house and would again several times, finding Jefferson no less engaging than ever, but overly fond of extravagant claims and large stories. One evening, John Quincy listened in amazement as Jefferson described how, during one of his winters in Paris, the temperature had dropped to 20 below zero for 6 weeks. It was a preposterous claim. Nothing of the sort had ever happened, as John Quincy knew from having been there. "He knows better than all this, but loves to excite wonder." At another point, commenting on the French Revolution, Jefferson said it seemed all to have been a dream. John Quincy, as he reported to his father, could hardly believe his ears. Jefferson had installed a French chef in the presidential mansion. His wine bill alone exceeded $2,500 a year. There was, as usual, the dissertation upon wines, not very edifying, John Quincy recorded after another dinner. Mr. Jefferson said that the Epicurean philosophy came nearest to the truth, in his opinion, of any ancient system of philosophy. In addition to serving in the Senate, John Quincy also accepted a new professorial chair of rhetoric and oratory at Harvard. Adams's pride in his brilliant son could not have been greater. As he let him know when at times John Quincy grew discouraged with the pettiness and hypocrisies of politics. Patience and perseverance will carry you with honor through all difficulties. Virtuous and studious from your youth, beyond any other instance I know, I have great confidence in your success in the service of your country, however dark your prospects may be at present. Such talents and such learning as you possess, with a character so perfectly fair and a good humor so universally acknowledged, it is impossible for you to fail. Reminding him of their ordeal on the Boston, when you and I clasped each other together in our arms and braced our feet against the bedboards and bedsteads to prevent us from having our brains dashed out, Adams said he himself had since weathered worse political storms. And here I am, alive and hearty yet. Alive and hearty he was, and remarkably so, all things considered. He was a picture of health, as visitors and family members would attest. He still nursed wounds of defeat. He could brood over past insults. He longed for vindication and for gratitude for so much that he had done and the sacrifices he had made. And he dwelled often on death. Dear old friends were passing from the scene, Parson Wyburd, Samuel Adams. He was never more to see anything but my plow between me and the grave, Adams told a correspondent, sounding more than a little sorry for himself. Yet, in the same letter, he claimed to be happier than he had ever been, which, if said partly for effect as a matter of pride, was also fundamentally true. Once the initial years of retirement had passed, and particularly after he began writing again. In early 1805, after 4 years at Quincy, during which he had made little effort to contact others, Adams decided to send a letter of greetings to his old friend Benjamin Rush. "Dear sir," Adams began on February 6th, "it seemed to me that you and I ought not to die without saying goodbye, or bidding each other adieu. Pray, how do you do? How does that excellent lady, Mrs. R.? Is the present state of the National Republic enough? Is virtue the principle of our government? Is honor? Or is ambition and avarice, adulation, baseness, covetousness, the thirst for riches, indifference concerning the means of rising and enriching, the contempt of principle, the spirit of party and of faction, the motive and principle that governs?" "My much respected and dear friend," Rush answered, "your letter of the 6th instant revived a great many pleasant ideas in my mind. I have not forgotten, I cannot forget you. You and your excellent Mrs. Adams often compose a conversation by my fireside. We now and then meet with a traveler who has been at Quincy, from whom we hear with great pleasure not only that you enjoy good health, but retain your usual good spirits." And so began an extended, vivid correspondence between the two men that was to occupy much of their time and bring each continuing enjoyment. For Adams, it was as if he had found a vocation again. His letters to Rush became a great outpouring of ideas, innermost feelings, pungent asides, and opinions on all manner of things and mutual acquaintances, so much that he had kept within for too long. He wrote of his worries about the future and the sham of the political scene. "My friend, our country is a masquerade. No party, no man dares to avow his real sentiments. All is disguise, vizard, cloak." Much of his strength and capacity for study were gone, Adams professed, "but such is the constitution of my mind that I cannot avoid forming an opinion. Samuel Johnson said when he sat upon his throne in a tavern, there he dogmatized and was contradicted, and in this he found delight. My throne is not in a tavern, but at my fireside. There I dogmatize, there I laugh, and there the newspapers sometimes make me scold. And in dogmatizing, laughing, and scolding I find delight, and why should not I enjoy it, since no one is the worse for it, and I am the better? He had by now resumed work on his autobiography as well. Part 2, Travels and Negotiations. Though it was still labor he did not relish. To rummage trunks, letter books, bits of journals, and great heaps of bundles of old papers is a dreadful bondage to old age, and an extinguisher of old eyes. And how, after all, did one write about oneself? He asked Rush. What must he say of his own vanity and levity? How was he to account for so many impulsive, tactless, ill-considered things he had said down the years? There have been very many times when I have been so agitated in my own mind as to have no consideration at all of the light in which my words, actions, and even writings would be considered by others. Indeed, I never could bring myself seriously to consider that I was a great man or of much importance or consideration in the world. The few traces that remain of me must, I believe, go down to posterity in much confusion and distraction, as my life has passed. Enough, surely, of egotism. He wrote of how greatly friendship mattered to him. There is something in my composition which restrains me from rancor against any man with whom I have once lived in friendship. He wrote of his sense of duty to his country. Our obligations to our country never cease but with our lives. And the threats he saw to the country. The internal intrigues of our moneyed and landed and slaved aristocracies are and will be our ruin. He reported to the learned physician of his own health and disposition, assuring him, "My spirits have been as cheerful as they ever were since some sin to me unknown involved me in politics." And he described his physical activities, which began at 5 or 6 in the morning with work on his stone walls. "I call for my levers and iron bars, for my chisels, drills, and wedges to split rocks, and for my wagons to cart seaweed for manure upon my farm. I mount my horse and ride on the seashore, and I walk upon Mount Wollaston and Stonyfield Hill." For a healthful diet, he told the abstemious Rush, he believed, like the doctors of his youth, in milk and vegetables, with very little animal food and still less spirituous liquors. In his autobiography, however, Adams told how his excellent father had encouraged him to partake of more meat as well as more comforting drink than milk. He wrote of his renewed enjoyment of Shakespeare. Adams would read Shakespeare twice through again in 1805, and in his continued devotion to Cicero and the Bible. And he dwelt much on ideas. The ideal of the perfectibility of man as expounded by 18th-century philosophers, perfectibility abstracted from all divine authority, was unacceptable, he declared. It is an idea of the Christian religion, and ever has been of all believers of the immortality of the soul, that the intellectual part of man is capable of progressive improvement forever. Where, then, is the sense of calling the perfectibility of man an original idea or modern discovery? I consider the perfectibility of man, as used by modern philosophers, to be mere words without a meaning, that is, mere nonsense. He had himself, he told Rush, an immense load of errors, weaknesses, follies, and sins to mourn over and repent of. These were the only affliction of his present life. But St. Paul had taught him to rejoice evermore and be content. This phrase, rejoice evermore, shall never be out of my heart, memory, or mouth again as long as I live, if I can help it. This is my perfectibility of man. The letters sparkled with aphorisms. On the virtue of America standing free from binding involvement with other nations. We stand well, let us stand still. On the perils of majority rule. Absolute power in a majority is as drunk as it is in one. On lawyers. No civilized society can do without lawyers. Of kings and presidents, Adams said he saw little to distinguish them from other men. If worthless men are sometimes at the head of affairs, it is, I believe, because worthless men are at the tail and the middle. In a spirited appraisal of the overall falderall of an election year, he wrote, "Our electioneering racers have started for the prize. Such a whipping and spurring and huzzahing! Oh, what rare sport it will be! Through thick and thin, through mire and dirt, through bogs and fens and sloughs, dashing and splashing and crying out, the devil take the hindmost! How long will it be possible that honor, truth, or virtue should be respected among a people who are engaged in such a quick and perpetual succession of such profligate collisions and conflicts?" Rush, a champion of reform in education, thought Greek and Latin were outmoded and should be replaced by the study of modern languages, which Adams considered thoroughly wrong-headed. "Your labors will be as useless as those of Tom Paine against the Bible," Adams declared, but wrote also, "Mrs. Adams says she is willing for you to discredit Greek and Latin, because it will destroy the foundation of all pretensions of the gentleman to superiority over the ladies, and restore liberty, equality, and fraternity between the sexes." Adams made frequent mention of his high regard for physicians as professional men and as friends. Benjamin Waterhouse was a jewel of a man. Cotton Tufts was one of the best men in the world. And the respect and affection he felt for Rush were abundantly apparent, even in the ways Adams would address him. "Honored and learned sir, my dear philosopher and friend, my sensible and humorous friend, learned, ingenious, benevolent, beneficent old friend of 1774, my dear old friend. I am not subject to low spirits," Adams would tell Rush, "but if I was, one of your letters would cure me at any time for a month." For all their differences in political views, neither man had ever abandoned the other. When, in the aftermath of the yellow fever epidemics of 1793 and 1797, Rush had been publicly attacked for his bloodletting treatment, both by Philadelphia physicians and the press, and his practice dwindled to the point that he could barely survive, Adams, who was then president and struggling with troubles of his own, had appointed him treasurer of the United States Mint. It had been a generous act of friendship that Rush and his family never forgot. Though bound by political philosophy to Jefferson, Rush felt a closer personal tie to Adams. Rush proved an eager and engaging correspondent, his letters brimming with opinion and vitality, and quite as candid as Adams's own. "You see," Rush wrote, "I think aloud in my letters to you as I did in those written near 30 years ago, and as I have often done in your company." But then they were both thinking aloud, both writing the way they spoke, each keeping the other company with common interest and shared miseries. If Adams had been rejected by the vote of the people, Rush had been made an outcast by much of his own profession. Each was lonely except for friends and family. "I live like a stranger in my native state," Rush confided. "My patients are my only acquaintances, my books my only companions, and the members of my family nearly my only friends." If Adams thought he might have been better off as a shoemaker, Rush would tell him, "I often look back upon the hours I spent serving my country, so unproductive of the objects to which they were devoted, with deep regret." But much that Rush wrote was exactly the medicine Adams needed. As if the old physician in Philadelphia understood his distant patient perfectly. "Mr. Madison and his lady are now in our city," he reported to Adams. "It gave me great pleasure to hear him mention your name in the most respectful terms a few days ago. He dwelt upon your genius and integrity, and acquitted you of ever having had the least friendly designs in your administration upon the present forms of our American governments." Madison did not consider Adams a monarchist, in other words. "He gave you credit likewise for your correct opinion of banks and standing armies in our country." To Adams, Rush was a true cohort in the original meaning of the word, one belonging to the same division of a Roman legion and united in the same struggle. With Rush, Adams felt free to say things not possible with just anyone, as, for example, in appraising those they had known in the struggle. "When considering George Washington," said Adams, "one must always bear in mind that he was a Virginian," which was worth at least 5 talents, in that Virginian geese are all swans. Washington, furthermore, was a great actor who had the gift of silence, which, wrote Adams, "I esteem as one of the most precious talents." Washington was too unlearned and had seen too little of the world for someone in his station. Still, Washington was a thoughtful man and had great self-command, a quality Adams admired in the extreme. Dabbling in medical theory, Adams suggested that all Hamilton's overheated ambitions and impulses might be attributed to a superabundance of secretions which he could not find whores enough to draw off, and that the same vapors produced his lies and slanders by which he totally destroyed his party forever and finally lost his life in the field of honor. Knowing how much Rush admired Jefferson, Adams was nonetheless equally candid on the subject. Hamilton was a great intriguer, but so too was Jefferson, Adams wrote. "Jefferson has succeeded, and multitudes are made to believe that he is pure benevolence, but you and I know him to be an intriguer." He held no resentment against Jefferson, though he has honored and salaried almost every villain he could find who had been an enemy to me. Nor would he publicly criticize Jefferson's handling of the presidency. "I think instead of opposing systematically any administration, running down their characters and opposing all their measures, right or wrong, we ought to support every administration as far as we can in justice." The resumption of correspondence with Benjamin Rush was one of the happiest events of Adams's life in retirement. Rush's wife remarked that the two elderly gentlemen were behaving like a couple of schoolgirls, and though they were never to see one another, the friendship grew stronger than ever. But while Rush substantiated so much that Adams liked to believe about the meaning of friendship, another old friend, Mercy Otis Warren, hurt and provoked him as no one had in years and without warning. In 1806, Mercy Warren published her History of the Rise, Progress, and Termination of the American Revolution, in which she singled out Adams as one of those who had betrayed the Revolution. Adams, she declared, reviving the old charge, had been corrupted by his time in England. The man who had appeared to be actuated by the principles of integrity became beclouded by a partiality for monarchy, by living long near the splendor of courts and courtiers, and came home enamored by rank, titles, and all the insignia of arbitrary sway. The most prominent features of his character, she further charged, were pride of talents and much ambition. Mr. Adams's passions and prejudices were sometimes too strong for his sagacity and judgment, she observed. With Bache, Callender, and Alexander Hamilton all in their graves, Adams could only have assumed that such accusations were things of the past. Like nearly everyone who ever played a large part in public life and helped make history, Adams wondered how history would portray him, and worried not a little that he might be unfairly treated, misunderstood, or his contributions made to look insignificant compared to those of others. He had no great expectation of being celebrated. No statues or monuments would be erected in his memory, he told Rush, adding, "I wish them not," which was hardly so. It was an understandable desire to make his own case before the bar of history that propelled him in his labors at autobiography. But to have such a blow as this fall now in his old age and inflicted by a friend was infuriating. In his years in office, Adams had felt obliged to say nothing when subjected to ridicule and abuse. But now he felt no such restraint, and in a series of letters he unleashed his wrath as he seldom had, demonstrating, just as Mercy Warren had said, that his passions could at times overcome his sagacity, but also how deeply she had hurt him. "What have I done, Mrs. Warren," he wrote, "to merit so much malevolence from a lady concerning whom I never in my life uttered an unkind word or disrespectful insinuation?" "Corrupted?" he exploded. "Madam, corruption is a charge that I cannot and will not bear. I challenge the whole human race, and angels and devils too, to produce an instance of it from my cradle to this hour." He denied still again any partiality for monarchy, and implied that she was getting even with him for once refusing to give her husband a federal job. To be charged with a surfeit of ambition cut deepest, it would appear. An overweening ambition was the flaw Adams so often attributed to others that he warned his sons against and that privately he recognized in himself. But to see it brought against him in print was another matter. "Ambition is the most lively in the most intelligent and most generous minds," he asserted. However, "if by ambition you mean love of power or a desire of public offices, I answer I never solicited a vote in my life for any public office. I never swerved from any principle. I never professed any opinion. I never concealed even any speculative opinion to obtain a vote. I never sacrificed a friend or betrayed a trust. I never hired scribblers to defame my rivals. I never wrote a line of slander against my bitterest enemy, nor encouraged it in any other." In reply, Mercy Warren protested the rambling manner in which your angry and undigested letters are written. When the letters kept coming, she accused him of vulgarisms and worse. "There is a meanness as well as malignancy in striving to blast a work that many of the best judges of literary merit have spoken of as very flattering to the author." The letters finally stopped, and by all signs the lifelong friendship between the Adamses and the Warrens had ended, which was deeply troubling on both sides. In time, however, the break would heal, and correspondence between them would resume. In the meantime, the episode had shown that Adams was quite as capable as ever of furious indignation. The old lion could still roar. Never wholeheartedly devoted to the task of writing his autobiography, he now abandoned the project altogether and launched into a lengthy, some thought interminable, spate of letters to the Boston Patriot, his last passionate exercise in self-justification. At the start, he concentrated on answering the charges leveled by Hamilton in the heat of the 1800 election, then continued on to review his role in foreign affairs, from his difficulties with Franklin in Paris, to the dismissal of Timothy Pickering, to the XYZ affair and the missions to France. He became the attorney for the accused, fierce and vivid in defense, writing with exceptional vigor and not a little self-admiration, even occasional wonderment at his own virtuous tenacity in the face of opposition and intrigue. The letters appeared almost weekly for 3 years, until Adams, too, it appears, realized how tiresome he had become and called a halt. Voltaire boasted that he made 4 presses groan for 60 years, but I have to repent that I made the Patriot groan for 3, he later wrote to a friend, aware that his efforts had been largely in vain. The daily rounds and established patterns of domestic life continued within the Adams homestead, which had come to be called the Big House, to distinguish it from the other houses by Penn's Hill, and an eyewitness account written years afterward by a kinsman is notable not only for its portraits of the elderly Abigail and John at home in or about the year 1808, but as evidence that domestic economy, too, pertained no less than ever. Josiah Quincy, a cousin of Abigail's, was 6 or 7 years old when he began attending Sunday dinners at the Big House, which would have been an ordeal for a boy, he wrote, except for the genuine kindness of the president, who had not a chip of an iceberg in his composition. With Mrs. Adams, there was a shade more formality, a consciousness of age and dignity, which was often somewhat oppressive, was customary with old people of that day in the presence of the young. Something of this Mrs. Adams certainly had, though it wore off or came to be disregarded by me, for in the end I was strongly attached to her. It was with certain pride, too, that he, as a Quincy, saw her as one of the last of the true, old-style New England ladies of another era. She was always dressed handsomely, and her rich silks and laces seemed appropriate to a lady of her dignified position in the town. If there was a little savor of patronage in the generous hospitality she exercised among her simple neighbors, it was never regarded as more than a natural emphasis of her undoubted claims to precedence. The aristocratic colonial families were still recognized, for the tide of democracy had not risen high enough to cover all its distinctions. The parentage and descent of Mrs. Adams were undoubtedly of weight establishing her position. Though, as we now look at things, the strong personal claims of herself and husband would seem to have been all sufficient. Sunday dinners, served at 1 o'clock, he remembered as sufficiently plentiful but modest, and beginning invariably with a pudding of cornmeal, molasses, and butter. This was the custom of the time, it being thought desirable to take the edge off of one's hunger before reaching the joint of veal or mutton. Indeed, it was considered wise to stimulate the young to fill themselves with pudding, by the assurance that the boys who managed to eat the most of it should be helped most abundantly to the meat which was to follow. It need not be said that neither the winner nor his competitors found much room for meat at the close of their contest, and so the domestic economy of the arrangement was very apparent. When the time came for the meat course, Louisa Smith did the carving while the president made his contribution in the form of good-humored, easy banter. What Adams talked about, his young guest was unable to recall in later years, though he remembered distinctly a certain iron spoon which the old gentleman once fished up from the depth of a pudding in which it had been unwittingly cooked. With dinner ended, nearly all at the table went a second time to church. At tea, following church, another guest would recount, topics of conversation could range from religion, politics, and literature to Mrs. Siddons, Shakespeare, and Benedict Arnold. Like countless grandparents in all times, Abigail worried that she might be spoiling the grandchildren under her charge. I begin to think grandparents not so well qualified to educate grandchildren as parents, she wrote to Nabby. They are apt to relax in their spirit of government and be too indulgent. It was a thought that appears never to have concerned John Adams. By the time Jefferson's second term was underway, Bonaparte had crowned himself the Emperor Napoleon and with his victorious armies had become master of Europe. France and Britain were still at war, and on the high seas both the French and the British were again attacking American commerce, seizing American ships, and impressing American seamen. More than 1,000 ships and millions of dollars in goods had been lost, and everywhere in the country debate raged over what to do. Determined to avoid war, Jefferson called for an embargo on all American shipping, which John Adams, like most New Englanders, saw as a catastrophe for New England, if not the nation. But alone of the Federalists in Congress, John Quincy supported and voted for the embargo as a worthy experiment, the same term used by Jefferson. If ever a nation was guilty of imprudence, ours has been so in making a naval force and marine preparations unpopular, Adams wrote to Rush. He thought the embargo a cowardly measure. He had always been against embargoes, but he would raise no clamor now, being determined to support the government in whatever hands as far as I can in conscience and honor. When Massachusetts Federalists denounced John Quincy as no longer one of the party, Adams wrote to him to say he wished they would denounce him the same way, for he had long since abdicated and disclaimed the name and character and attributes of that sect as it now appears. The embargo proved a colossal mistake for the country and a catastrophe for New England. For John Quincy, it meant the end of his Senate career. In 1808, the Massachusetts legislature elected a successor even earlier than they had to, which prompted John Quincy to resign before his term ended. If he or his father ever entertained any thought that Jefferson, before leaving office, might reward John Quincy for the support he had given, they were greatly disappointed, for this was not to happen. It was Jefferson's successor, James Madison, who, after taking office as president, rescued John Quincy from practicing law in Boston by appointing him minister to Russia. Abigail was crestfallen. She thought the appointment unsuitable and urged John Quincy not to accept. "The period is not yet arrived when your country demands you," she wrote. Adams differed, as much as he dreaded the thought of John Quincy in St. Petersburg. "As to my son, I would not advise him to refuse to serve his country when fairly called to it," he told Rush. "But as to myself, I would not exchange the pleasure I have in his society once a week for any office in or under the United States." By midsummer of 1809, John Quincy and Louisa Catherine had departed for Russia, taking with them the most recent addition to their family, 2-year-old Charles Francis Adams, while 8-year-old George and 5-year-old John remained behind in Quincy. "It was like taking our last leave," Abigail wrote. The separation, Adams told Rush, tore him to pieces. How long it might be until they saw them again, if ever, there was no telling. 2 months later, feeling the time was ripe, Rush sent Adams a memorable letter, dated October 17, 1809. With Jefferson also in retirement now, Rush thought it time for a renewal of the old friendship between Adams and Jefferson, and that he, Rush, as the friend of both, could help bring it about. He had been corresponding with Jefferson all along and thus felt he knew the hearts of both men. As part of his medical investigations, Rush had a long-standing interest in dreams. Dreams, he told his students, should be allowed to sport themselves idly in their brains. Observed, dreams could provide useful inferences. In the course of his correspondence with Adams, Rush had already related several dreams of his own. Now he had another to report. He had a dream of reading a history of America written at some point in the future, and of a particular page saying that among the most extraordinary events of the year 1809 was the renewal of friendship and correspondence between the two former presidents, Mr. John Adams and Mr. Thomas Jefferson. And it was Adams, according to Russia's dream history, who rekindled the old friendship. Mr. Adams addressed a short letter to his friend Mr. Jefferson, in which he congratulated him upon his escape to the shades of retirement and domestic happiness, and concluded it with assurances of his regard and good wishes for his welfare. This letter did great honor to Mr. Adams. It discovered a magnanimity known only to great minds. Mr. Jefferson replied to this letter and reciprocated expressions of regard and esteem. These letters were followed by a correspondence of several years. Delighted by Russia's good-natured performance, Adams replied, "A dream again! I wish you would dream all day and all night, for one of your dreams puts me in spirits for a month. I have no other objections to your dream but that it is not history. It may be prophecy." But then Adams did nothing, and no more was said of the matter. Silence between Stonyfield and Monticello continued. "Our reading has been all about Russia," Adams wrote to John Quincy that winter, when it looked for all the world like Russia outside Adams's window and the palsy in his hands was rather increased by the severe cold. He wrote of the pleasure he was taking in John Quincy's two sons, and of their progress in their studies. He reported on his own son, Thomas, who was by now married to Anne Harrod of Haverhill, and with his growing family had settled in the old house by Penn's Hill, where Adams had been born, and on Elbridge Gerry, who had lately been elected governor of Massachusetts. In October of 1810, Adams celebrated his 75th birthday. He had taken up reading modern epic poems and novels, romances, he reported to Rush, Walter Scott's Lady of the Lake, Jane Porter's Scottish Chiefs, and was finding great enjoyment in them. "My days glide smoothly away," he wrote early in the new year of 1811. Snow fell for 12 consecutive days, leaving drifts 10 feet high. "I am well. My appetite as good as ever," he reported after another 6 months had passed. "I sleep well nights. My natural vision is not bad, but I use glasses for ease to my eyes. My hearing is as good as ever." His only difficulties were the quiveration in his hands and a loss of voice. "It would divert you to witness conversation between my ancient friend and colleague Robert T. Paine and me. He is above 80. I cannot speak, and he cannot hear. Yet we converse." But 1811 was to be an almost unbearably difficult and painful year for the Adamses. Indeed, the most afflictive year they had known. In April, when his horse reared and threw him, Thomas was so badly injured it was feared he would be crippled for life. By early summer, Mary Cranch, who suffered from what was probably tuberculosis, appeared to be dying. Then Sally, Charles's widow, began spitting up blood, which, as Adams later reported to Benjamin Rush, confined her under the constant care of physicians for 3 or 4 months. One night in September, going out in the dark to view a comet, Adams tripped over a stake in the ground and ripped his leg open to the bone, so that for months he too was confined to the house, a doctor daily hovering to bathe and dress the wound. Abigail, who almost alone of the household remained on her feet, went back and forth across town to the Cranches, nursing her sister as well as those at home. Neither the morals of Epictetus or the Stoic philosophy of the ancients could avail to allay the tumult of grief excited by such a succession of distress, she wrote to John Quincy. But greatest was the anguish over Nabby, about whom Abigail said nothing yet to John Quincy, probably to spare him the worry. Nabby had discovered a hardness in her right breast, and had come on to Quincy from the farm in upstate New York, where she and Colonel Smith had been living for some while in near poverty. She consulted with Cotton Tufts and several physicians in Boston, and wrote to Benjamin Rush for his advice. The Boston doctors all advised the surgical removal of her breast, as did Rush in a thoughtful letter to her father. He preferred giving his opinion this way, Rush told Adams, so that he and Abigail could communicate it gradually. From the experience of more than 50 years in such cases, Rush said, he knew but one remedy, the knife. From her account of the moving state of the tumor, it is now in a proper situation for the operation. Should she wait till it suppurates or even inflames much, it may be too late. I repeat again, let there be no delay. Her time of life calls for expedition in this business, for tumors such as hers tend much more rapidly to cancer after 45 than in more early life. Nabby was 46. A mastectomy was performed on Nabby in the bedroom beside that of her mother and father on October 8th. As Adams wrote to Rush, the operation took 25 minutes, the dressing an hour longer. The agony she endured in that day before anesthetics is unimaginable. The four surgeons who performed the operation told Adams afterward that they had never known a patient to show such fortitude. 2 days later, on October 10th, the beloved Richard Cranch died of heart failure at age 85. And the day following, Mary Cranch died at age 70. For Abigail, it was the greatest loss since the death of Charles. The horror of Nabby's ordeal brought a marked change in Adams. The old shows of temper were not to be seen again. He became more mellow, more accepting of life, and forgiving. He had felt during Nabby's agony, he said, as if he were living in the book of Job. Just before Christmas, Adams heard again from Benjamin Rush, who wished to remind him of a visit Adams had had the summer before from two young men from Virginia. They were brothers named Coles, Albemarle County neighbors of Jefferson's, and in the course of conversation, Adams had at length exclaimed, "I always loved Jefferson, and I still love him." This had been carried back to Monticello, and was all Jefferson needed to hear. To Rush, he wrote, "I only needed this knowledge to revive towards him all the affections of the most cordial moments of our lives." "And now, my dear friend," declared Rush to Adams, "permit me again to suggest to you to receive the olive branch offered to you by the hand of a man who still loves you." On New Year's Day, 1812, seated at his desk in the second-floor library, Adams took up his pen to write a short letter to Jefferson, very like the one Rush had prophesied in his dream. Section 4. It was a brief, cordial note to wish Jefferson many happy New Years and to say he could expect to receive a bit of homespun lately produced in this quarter by one who was honored in his youth with some of your attention and much of your kindness. Posted separately, the homespun was a copy of John Quincy's Lectures on Rhetoric and Oratory. But before it could arrive, Jefferson had concluded that it must be some article of home-produced clothing. And so, in reply to Adams, wrote at length about the virtues of the spinning jenny and loom, and of the thriftiness of household manufactures. If, as stage managed by Rush, it had been left to Adams to make the first move, Jefferson more than fulfilled his part. "A letter from you calls up recollections very dear to my mind," he continued. "It carried me back to the times when, Beset with difficulties and dangers, we were fellow laborers in the same cause, struggling for what is most valuable to man, his right of self-government. Jefferson was fond of images of storm-tossed seas and employed them often as he did now, though in his own travels at sea he himself had known only smooth sailing. Laboring always at the same oar, with some wave ever ahead threatening to overwhelm us, and yet passing harmless under our bark, we knew not how we rode through the storm with heart and hand and made a happy port. Like Adams, he claimed to be out of touch with politics, which was hardly so. He was kept abreast regularly by Madison and Monroe, among others. "I have given up newspapers in exchange for Tacitus and Thucydides, for Newton and Euclid," he wrote, which was also an overstatement, but one certain to please his fellow classical scholar at Quincy. Adams answered in high spirits, and at greater length than Jefferson had written to him. "What an exchange have you made of newspapers for Newton," he wrote. "Rising from the lower deep of the lowest deep of dullness and bathos to the contemplation of the heavens and the heavens of the heavens." Responding to Jefferson's figurative storm at sea, Adams recalled again his own real voyage on the Boston, chased by British frigates, struck by a hideous tempest of thunder and lightning, the mainmast split, 20 men down, one dead. It was the story of his life, he said. "I walk every fair day," he told Jefferson, "sometimes 3 and 4 miles. Ride, now and then, but very rarely more than 10 or 15 miles.